Well, good morning, everybody. Very pleased to be here. It's an honour to be part of this conference, which is quite impressive in terms of its organisation and the range of topics that are going to be covered. And many thanks also to the organisers and the sponsors, to the President and the Director General. I want to raise some more theoretical issues. It's still a bit early in the morning, isn't it, to be thinking about theory. So I'll start off by indicating what I'm going to be saying, and then I'll go through that in a little bit more detail. My topic is free speech, communication, and the state. And what I'll be doing is looking at the right to free speech, the practice of communication, and the role of the state in relation to those. So what I'll start off by doing is pointing out that the development of new media has important implications for the way we look at freedom of speech, the way we think about it. I'll use freedom of speech and freedom of expression interchangeably, generally. So I'll look at the traditional approach to freedom of speech expression, and then I'll suggest a possible challenge to that. In my view, the traditional approach to freedom of expression involves a conception of speech which doesn't really make sense. And it therefore leads to a rather narrow view of freedom of speech. I'll then go on to look at what I think is more properly to be considered the nature of speech activity, the speech activity that we value. And I will suggest that there is a stronger justification then for a stronger conception of freedom of speech. This will have implications for speech in general, but particularly for the media. And I'll talk about two areas, one relating to access to the media, and the other relating to positive obligations that may be imposed on the media. All this is to suggest that state interference in freedom of expression, which may include state interference in the media, is not necessarily undesirable. I'll go further and say that it may actually be required. So, looking at the implications then of the media, the implications of new media, we see that the transition from mass broadcasting to digital interactive distribution has led to increased diffidence, a lack of confidence about the importance of making a special case for regulating media. We have media regulation traditionally because there are problems in the way that the industry works for the dissemination of viewpoints. Once you start having interactive services that allow users to make their own choices about when and how to receive content, the argument becomes apparently more compelling that we should reduce interference in media activity and, more broadly, free speech activity, and just let users make the choices for themselves about what they want to engage in. So the overall, a big generalisation, the overall effect of this move towards convergence, towards more interactive kind of communication, is that there's increasing disapproval of interference in free speech, and there's a tendency to see free speech much more in terms of a libertarian conception, one which disapproves of state interference in speech at all. This move goes to reassert the traditional kind of approach to free speech and its justifications. And that traditional approach is probably reflected generally in the kind of free speech jurisprudence that we heard about in the United States a moment ago. Now, free speech has an unusual status, as perhaps you're aware, in political theory, because the normal kind of liberal approach is to say that you can do what you want. I'm generalising greatly, of course. You can do what you want as long as it doesn't cause harm. But if it does cause harm, it may be justifiable to interfere. But with free speech, or rather speech initially, we say by and large, speech is so important that if you do want to interfere with free speech, even if it causes harm, you need a special justification. And the usual kind of justifications that are offered are that it enhances the discovery or appreciation of truth, that it encourages participation in democracy, or that perhaps it enables self-fulfillment, enables individuals to achieve their aspirations and their life goals in some way. Now, those justifications really go to say that speech is somehow special and very important. And there are various objections to them and problems with them, and we haven't got time to look at them here. But the point is to try to create a special reason for dealing with speech that is different from freedom itself, that's different from liberty. It's not simply about interference with liberty, it's about something more than that. And the most basic kind of rationale for giving speech special treatment is actually something much more basic than truth and democracy and individual fulfillment. It's something to do with the idea that we should be cautious about accepting claims that speech does cause harm. We shouldn't be willing to accept that. We should give speech the benefit of the doubt because speech is important. And connected with that is an idea that we should have a deep distrust of government's ability to make distinctions between what is acceptable speech and what is not acceptable speech. Politicians are fallible. We should generally be sceptical about government in general. They can't be trusted to service properly. Once this kind of approach becomes accepted, it's easy then to characterise free speech almost as the absence of any kind of interference by government. And that implies that possible benefits of government interference are beyond consideration. We shouldn't be even contemplating that. Government can't make any positive, positive contribution to speech. It's also implied in this that the most important kind of interference that we should be thinking about is government interference. The implication there is that other kinds of interference either don't exist or aren't important. And the kind of interference I'm thinking of particularly here might, and I'll talk about it a little bit later, it would be media interference. You know, there's an assumption that media activity and speech is always a positive good. So that's the traditional approach to free speech. And it has been challenged, of course, and it has been challenged in the United States in theoretical discussion there. In particular, it's been pointed out that one can read some free speech jurisprudence not in terms of a lack of interference by government in speech, but in terms of allowing a multiplicity of voices, allowing discussion to take place. I think some of these ideas were touched on in the presentation earlier. But this kind of approach is not seen as important from a traditional perspective. It's seen as an adjunct to free speech. But the basic idea is that the purposes of free speech are not really connected with the liberty at all. They're connected with things like equality of access, say, or maybe some sense of welfare, you know, what is good in a democracy, what is good in society. And those are not really about liberty. They're separate from their important values. They may need to be balanced against liberty, but they're not actually part of liberty itself. Now, what I want to suggest is that one can actually maybe look at liberty itself, which has been kind of taken for granted, something that shouldn't be interfered with, and then you deal with conflicting values on the other side and try to balance them. But if you look at the liberty itself, the liberty of speech itself, there may be grounds within that for suggesting that state interference is not necessarily always a bad thing. How can I go about doing that? Well, one important distinction that's made in the traditional approach is to separate out so-called freedom from freedom to. So it's said that freedom of speech is really about freedom from interference, who by the state. And that's separate from what you do with your freedom. Freedom to what? Freedom to participate in democracy, freedom to discover knowledge, and so on and so forth. So the important thing is to concentrate on the freedom from, and all the other things are freedom to, and they're not connected. This is a curious kind of distinction in some ways, and it's one that seems to play quite strongly in free speech doctrine, but doesn't play so strongly, I think, in wider political theory. Many years ago, in the late 1960s, McCallum wrote an article called Negative and Positive Freedom, in which he analysed the nature of freedom, the conceptual nature of freedom. And his basic point, important point for our purposes, is that you should really think beyond the idea of freedom from and freedom to. Any concept of freedom, he said, is only intelligible if you recognise that there are three dimensions to it. There are always three dimensions. One is indeed freedom from something. One is indeed freedom to do or not to do or become something. And the other aspect is it's freedom of something. It's freedom of some kind of agent. Now, his point was, and I think it's a valuable point, I would, wouldn't I, because I'm using it to make the argument, is that you should think of all these three things together. You don't artificially separate out freedom from the agent and from what the agent wants to do. To concentrate on only two of these things and to emphasise the one, to emphasise freedom from, is actually to lead to the wrong sort of questions being asked. So if you start asking different kinds of questions, you might need to go and analyse what is the nature of each of these relationship, each of these components of the overall relationship that's contained in the freedom. In our case, the freedom of speech, freedom of expression. So what I'd like to do now is to say something about each of those, to try to concretise it a little bit. So if we look at the activity in question, so thinking now about the freedom to do things, well, what is it that we want to do? Well, the traditional approach to free speech encourages a rather abstract way of thinking about the liberty. I think it's a weak conception of speech because it doesn't really say much about the substance of the activity that has to be that needs to be conveyed. The major consideration is non-interference. The main emphasis is on what is not is on the lack of interference. There's not very much focus on what exactly there's no interference being done with. So it's worth asking, why do we value speech? We value speech because it's through language and symbolic forms that thought can be articulated. I hope I'm not stating the obvious too much here. Thought is that there's the manifestation of our very identity. It's obvious that its articulation can be seen to be a very important overriding or even fundamental right. But usually, I think, one would think that the overriding interest extends beyond the mere freedom to articulate. There are some people who are recluses who might want to take themselves off into a desert or a forest and not speak to anybody. But apart from that, most human beings typically live in a social environment where it's the possibility of interaction with others which is the key value of speech. So when you want to display your personality, it is to others. You want to persuade others of your point of view. You want to learn from others. You want to, it may not just be rational communication, it may be emotional. You know, you may want to expose emotional connections, emotional fissures, arguments, and so on. And indeed, the whole possibility of communicating to others is what establishes us as agents, as individuals. Now, this is something that is not particularly controversial, I think, in, as I said, political theory more generally. But the traditional approach to freedom of expression seems to be targeted at a very abstract representation of humans. The condition for existence of speech in the traditional approach seems to be simply the ability to make a noise. So if you can stand at the street corner and shout at somebody and call to them or just make grunts and nobody interferes with that, you've got freedom of speech. Well, that doesn't seem to be very persuasive to me. At the very, I think implicitly in the idea of free speech, if not articulated, is the idea that one will communicate. And it's quite interesting, actually, when you look at discussion of traditional free speech, the general expectation is that speech will be communicated in debate and in discussion. We expect discussion, we expect speech to be used. In fact, one of the standard kind of liberal exponents of free speech doctrine, the British philosopher John Stuart Mill, constantly talks about the importance of the value of free speech being used to engage with others. His conception of free speech depended upon his background idea of an involved political activist kind of individual who'd make a contribution to society. And that's what free speech was there for him for. Okay, so free speech in its traditional approach has a rather narrow conception of what it is to speak. If one were to think more positively about a more active conception of speech, one would want to reflect that surely in the liberty that one wants to protect. Rather than having an individualistic perspective, the man or woman shouting on the street corner to no apparent effect, one would want to think of being able to engage in conversation. And that, at a minimum then, that would involve a liberty that involves being able, protection for being able to invite others to discuss, to engage in conversation with one. I think it's probably going too far to suggest that once one's invited somebody, at least to be aware of one's viewpoint, that one should then insist that they listen to you. That's probably going a bit too far. There probably isn't a right, I would think, to be heard or a right to be read, because that involves too much cooperation from the other party. But at the very least, I would have thought that freedom of speech involves protection of the ability to initiate an interaction with others. If you are prepared to accept that, and the argument goes into more detail, but my time is running out, the implications of that are that we have to think about various ways of allowing this kind of speech to be protected. We wouldn't want, looking at the other elements of the three-part relationship, in terms of impediment, interference with speech, we wouldn't necessarily want to think that all efforts to shape speech should be seen as inimical to discussion and participation in conversation. And that would include maybe interference to ensure that debate can take place in a constructive way, that speakers do have the right to be heard and they're not drowned out. And one would want to apply that to all kinds of speakers. Concentrating on different kinds of speaker then and putting this all together, a particularly important kind of speaker in this discussion would of course be the media. What kind of speakers are they? Are they simply reflecting their own opinion, or are they reflecting some kind of institutional standpoint? I think that the idea that the media have freedom that is the same as individual freedom of speech is not a claim that can be easily sustained. Institutional speech is not the same as individual speech. Institutional speech can actually interfere with the very kind of speech activity that I've been talking about. And what that implies is that if one wants to protect freedom of speech, one may have to constrain certain kinds of others' speech activities. An important kind of speech activity that would be involved would be media activity. It's not to say that the media do not help individuals to speak. Of course they do. And individual journalists and editors have their own right to free speech implicit in that. But as part of the media organisation more generally, quite a lot of media activity may have the effect of not allowing others to speak. We know that there are business models and proprietorial interests that shape media activity in particular directions, and that seems inconsistent with allowing others to speak freely. So the implications of this kind of approach to free speech, a stronger version of free speech, a more positive version of free speech, is that one can and should think more positively about the way that access to the media is constructed. Full-blown access to the media, allowing everybody to have access to media platforms, is impractical and probably not justifiable more generally. But a stronger, more positive version of free speech seems to entail that editors do give serious attention to speakers' wishes to connect with their audiences or readerships. So editors may therefore, thinking of practical manifestations of this, editors may need to inform the audience that there are other points of view, there are ranges of viewpoints. They may need to provide a more representative selection of viewpoints. Obviously, the internet these days and the use of blogging and writing comments on pieces makes it easier to achieve that. Once there is a conversation or discussion joined, there may be a need to try to structure that debate or structure exchanges to allow the parties to make a contribution. So a stronger conception of freedom of speech does allow the possibility of moderating speech, not to be seen as an interference, but has to be seen as a shaping for the constructive development of conversation. Other positive policy measures which would flow from this approach, some of them are not controversial in one way, but they're often not seen as part of liberty, but are seen as part of other objectives. Media pluralism is an important example. We think it might be important to structure media ownership and concentration of ownership in order to get a plurality of viewpoints. That comes not only from a democratic justification, I'm suggesting, but it also comes from a broader conception of freedom of speech itself, a stronger conception of speech that is about conversing, about communicating with others. And similarly, one might also in this vein then think about different kinds of positive content obligations. This plays more strongly in Europe. Obviously, in the United States, the notion of content neutrality is pretty much key. And so, because of the traditional view of free speech, it's seen that government should never try to put a finger on the approval or disapproval of particular content. But I think a strong conception of free speech does justify content regulation to include diversity of viewpoints. It may include requirements about securing impartiality, at least in the provision of news. And it may generally include requirements to reflect wider ranges of viewpoints from different communities, different groupings in a society, to have those reflected in media. So, to conclude, what I'm suggesting is that if it's accepted that the primary interest in the freedom to speak is the capacity to engage in dialogue with others, this has wider implications for the doctrine of free speech, and it suggests that in deciding what might be a justifiable interference with speech, the impact on exchange and dialogue should be the major consideration. And once you move down that route, then it doesn't seem to be obvious that no state interference in free speech, including media activity, should be ruled out. One should consider that there may well be positive benefits. Thank you.